Well, hello, and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast. It's Saturday morning where I am. Goodness knows where you're listening to this. And I'm just kicking back and relaxing. I had a big week this week. I finished a lot of big projects, and I'm about to embark on some more. And so that I'm in that kind of odd lull where it feels like a cowboy should step out of the shadows and say, it's quiet. Too quiet. Anyways, some of you wrote to say that the level on this podcast was a little odd. I think I fixed that. Let me know if this is blowing your eardrums, though. Other news from this week. Well, you know, I had Michael Ayers come and speak at my class, which was amazing. This Toshiba DRM lawyer, you know, he and I disagree pretty vehemently about some pretty important things, but he's very articulate. And he makes some interesting points. And what was really cool was he did this public talk in the evening, and some really senior Disney people showed up, as well as a bunch of activists and an ex-Intel engineer and cultural studies people from all over. And we had this great discussion, this roundtable discussion, which I've podcast since, or actually one of my students, a great online journalism master's candidate named Andy Sternberg, put up this podcast, and you can find the link to that on craphound.com and on Boing Boing. We've got a couple more great speakers coming in this week to do the same thing again. The first is Bruce Sterling, who you will know as one of the great science fiction writers of all time, also a great theorist, scholar, journalist, historian, gadfly, curmudgeon, and speaker. Everything I know about speaking, I learned from reading Bruce Sterling's speeches. He is just a hell of a guy. He's speaking on Monday. He's giving a public talk. If you're in Los Angeles, come on down and see him. Monday, 2 p.m. And this is Monday, September the 25th, in case you're getting this podcast in the future. Monday, the 25th, 2 p.m., Annenberg School, University of Southern California, main campus on Watt Way. And that's a smaller room, so get there early if you're going to come, because I think we're going to have a full house. Now, the next day at 7 p.m., we've got another completely mind-bogglingly awesome speaker whose name is also Bruce. On Tuesday the 26th, Bruce Schneier, who's one of the great security experts of all time, and also a great writer and speaker about security, someone who can explain security to a lay audience in a way that I've never heard any other security person or cryptographer do. He's going to come in and give a talk. Now, Bruce has got an amazing line on writing about and talking about how security and freedom are really the same thing, that if you trade freedom to get security, you're not really getting security, because the reason you want security is to safeguard your freedom. So if you have to give up the freedom to get it, you're getting a bad deal. It's really cool, and you know, there's never been a time when we needed to hear that message more than today. There's never been a time when the Constitution was more under assault, the idea of freedom was more under assault. Theme punks. I mentioned that I finished a big project this week. That big project was outlining all 160,000 words of theme punks to date. Theme punks is my next novel. I've been working on it now for a couple of years. Salon syndicated the first 50,000 words of it last year. And boy, it kept growing. It didn't want to come to a conclusion. And I sat down, I took a couple of months off from it. I sat down, I outlined it in real detail. The outline's like 15,000 words. It's, you know, longer than Ownsord by a damn sight. And in the process of doing that, I really came to know the story again. And I think I've got the ending now. So with any luck, 20,000 words more, wrap it up. Cut 50,000 words, because I think the longest Tor is going to let me get away with is 120 or maybe 130,000 words, and ship that puppy. So the story I'm reading today is Ownsord, and I'll remind you that Ownsord is available in a book that I wrote called A Place So Foreign and Eight More. That's a collection of short stories. It won the Sunburst Award for Best Canadian Anthology, or Best Canadian Science Fiction Book, I beg your pardon, a couple of years ago. And the stories in it have been shortlisted for the Locust and the Nebula and all kinds of awards. And really, they also won me my first big field genre award, which was the Campbell Award for Best New Writer, which I got at the Hugo Ceremonies in 2000 in Chicago at the Worldcon. So that's that I just leave with you as a reminder. That book is for sale, and you can order it from Amazon or buy it in finer bookstores. And a weird thing, speaking of old books, and I just mention this because it's got my head spinning. In 2000, I co-wrote my first book. I co-wrote it with a really talented writer named Carl Schrader, and it was The Complete Idiot's Guide to Publishing Science Fiction. I was approached by Renee Wilmeth, who was the editor of the series at the time, and she said, you know, we've had great luck with this Complete Idiot's Guide to Publishing. We're going to do one for romance, one for poetry, and whatever. Do you want to do one for science fiction? I said, well, I'm not a novelist, because I wasn't at the time. I know a lot about short stories, but nothing about novels. But I have a great novelist I know, Carl Schrader. Why don't we do it together? And she said that was a great idea. We, Carl's agent, who later became my agent for a while, negotiated the deal. We did the book. It sold a modest but healthy number. And then about 2 years ago, or no, maybe a year ago, they put it out of print. Which, you know, makes sense. It's a writing book. It's full of things like which markets you should submit your stories to. At 5 years later, that stuff is all completely out of date. And so, you know, that was kind of the last of it. And I thought, well, you know, that's not a bad life cycle for one of those books. You know, 5 years on the shelf, pretty cool. So then, I you know, every day I look at my little Amazon sales affiliate money, the money I get when you go to Boing Boing or Crap Hound and buy a book through one of those links I have to Amazon, I get like 5%. So, you know, it's not gigantic sums, but like over the course of a year, maybe a month's rent, it's not bad, especially since it doesn't really require a lot of work on my part. So I'm checking it out, and I see that people are buying copies of The Idiot's Guide still. It's nice, they're buying it used through Amazon, and then I see what they're paying for it, like $70. $70 for this book that was like, I don't know, $18 new? Maybe $15 new? And what's more, when I go and I actually look at the used pricing for this book, it starts at about $25. It goes up to $150. Now, you know, in Britain, they call those people chancers, right? People who say, oh, I'll charge $150 for it. Maybe someone will be naive enough to spend it. But still, who the hell wants to pay $150 for an old writing book? It's really flattering, but weird. Anyway, one of the things that, you know, I think Carl and I will do someday in our copious spare time, Carl's a father now and also in the middle of writing some completely amazing books, certainly the best work of his career. Sometime, though, I think we'd want to update this book, and you know, the fact that there are people out there willing to spend this kind of money on it tells me that that's probably worth our time. Well, anyways, here's the last installment of Ownzord, and, I think it'll be the last, yeah, the last installment of Ownzord, looking at the scroll bar and how much there is left to read, and I'm really thank you for all the nice things you said about this story as I went. Don't know yet what story I'm going to do next, but I'm sure it'll be a good one. Thank you all, and here we go. Murray hadn't counted on the coding. Liam tunneled into his box at the rooming house and dumped its drive to one of the old laptops lying around Murray's apartment. He set the laptop next to Murray while he drove to Fry's Electronics to get the cabling and components he needed to make the emitter receiver for the interface. They'd always had a running joke that you could build anything from parts at Fry's, but when Liam invoked it, Murray barely cracked a smile. He was stepping through the code in a debugger, reading the comments Liam had left behind as he deciphered its form and function. He was back in it. There was a runtime that simulated the platform as he tweaked the code, and he ran it on the simulator and checked out how his body would react if he executed it for real. Once he got a couple of liquidity events, he saw that Liam was right. They just weren't that hard to avoid. The API was great. There were function calls for just about everything. He delved into the cognitive stuff right off, since it was the area that was the rawest, that Liam had devoted the least effort to. At-will serotonin production, mnemonic perfection, endorphin production, adrenaline, Zen master on a disc. Who needs meditation and biofeedback and yoga when you can do it all in code? Out of habit, he was documenting as he went along, writing proper tutorials for the API, putting together printing, able to be slotted in as online help with the developer toolkit. Inspired by Joey, he began to work on a routine that would replace all the maintenance chores that the platform did in sleep mode, along with a subroutine that suppressed melatonin and all the other circadian chemicals that induced sleep. Liam returned from Fry's with bags full of cabling and soldering guns and breadboards. He dropped a black pillowcase over a patch of living room floor and laid everything out on it, wires and strippers and crimpers and components and a soldering gun, and went to work methodically, stripping and crimping and twisting. He'd taken out his own connector for reference, and he was comparing them both, using a white LED torch on a headband to show him the pinouts on the custom end. So I'm thinking that I'll clone the controller and stick it on my head first to make sure it works. You wear my wire and I'll burn in the new one in for a couple of days and then we can swap, okay? Sure, Murray said. Whatever. His fingers rattled on the keys. Got you one of these, Liam said, and held up a bulky Korean palm top. It runs Linux. You can cross-compile the SDK and all the libraries for it. The compiler's on the drive. Good if you want to run an interactive app, an application that changed its instructions based on output from the platform. And it's stinking cool, too. I fucking love Gear. Gear's good, Murray agreed. Cheap as hell and faster every time I turn around. Well, until honorable computing comes along, Liam said. That'll put a nail in the old coffin. You're overreacting. Nah, just being realistic. Open up a shell, okay? See at the top how it says TTY? The kernel thinks it's communicating with a printer, a teletype. Your shell window is a simulation of a printer, so the kernel knows how to talk to it. It's got plenty of compatibility layers between it and you. If the guy who wrote the code doesn't want you to interface with it, you can't. No emulation. That's not honorable. Your box is owned. Murray looked up from his keyboard. So what do you want me to do about it, dead man? Mostly dead, Liam said. Just think about it, okay? How much money you got in your savings account? Nice segue. Not enough. Not enough for what? Not enough for sharing it with you. Come on, dude. I'm going back underground. I need 50 grand to get out of the country, Canada, then buy a fake passport and head to London. Once I'm in the EU, I'm in good shape. I learned German last week. This week I'm doing French. That dendrite density shit is the shit. Man und Superman, Murray said. If you're so super, go and earn a buck or two, okay? Come on, you know I'm good for it. Once this stuff is ready to go? What stuff? The code base. Haven't you figured it out yet? It's a startup. We go into business in some former Soviet stan in Asia or some African kleptocracy. We infect the locals with the cure, then the interface, and then we sell them the software. It's viral marketing. Get it? Leaving aside CIA assassins, if only for the moment, there's one gigantic flaw in your plan, dead man. I'm all aflutter with anticipation. There's no fucking revenue opportunity. The platform spreads for free. It's already out there. You've seeded it with your magic undead supercock. The hardware is commodity hardware. No margin, no money. The controller can be built out of spare parts from Fry's. Next gen, we'll make it Wi-Fi so that we're using commodity wireless chipsets and you can control the device from a distance. Yeah, and that's why we're selling this software. Liam hopped from foot to foot in a personal folk dance, celebrating his sublime cleverness. In Buckfuckistan or Kleptomalia, where a wares dude is an honorable trade, we release our libraries and binaries and APIs, and 15 minutes later, they're burning CDs in every souk and selling them for 10 cents a throw. Nope, that's not going to happen. Why not? We're going to deploy on honorable hardware. I am not hearing this. Murray closed the lid of his laptop and tore into a slice of deep dish meat lover's pizza. You are not telling me this. You are. I am. It's only temporary. The interface isn't honorable, so anyone who reverse engineers it can make his own apps. We're just getting ours while the getting is good. All the good stuff, say pain control and universal antiviral hardening, we'll make for free, we'll viralize it. Once our stuff is in the market, though, the whole world's going to change anyway. There'll be apps for happiness, cures for every disease, hibernation, limb regeneration, whatever. Anything any human body has ever done, ever, you'll be able to do at will. You think there's going to be anything recognizable as an economy once we're that ubiquitous? Every morning upon rising, Murray looked down at his toes and thought, "Hello, toes." It had been 10 years since he'd had regular acquaintance with anything south of his gut, but his gut was gone, tight as a drumhead. He was free from scars and age marks and unsightly moles, and his beard wouldn't grow in again until he asked it to. When he thought about it, he could feel the dull ache of new teeth coming in underneath the ones that had grown discolored or chipped, the back molar with all the ugly amalgam fillings, but if he chose to ignore it, the pain simply went away. He flexed the muscles, great and small, all around his body. His fat index was low enough to see the definition of each of those superbly toned flabs of flexible contained energy. He looked like an anatomy lesson, and it was all he could do not to stare at himself in the mirror all day. But he couldn't do that. Not today, anyway. He was needed back at the office. He was already in the shitter at work over his unexpected trip to a health farm, and he felt that if he left it any longer, he'd be out on his toned ass. He hadn't been able to go out for new clothes. Liam had every liquid cent he could lay hands on, as well as his credit cards. He found a pair of ancient threadbare jeans and a couple of medium t-shirts that clung to the pecs that had grown up underneath his formerly sagging man boobs, and left for the office. He drew stares on the way to his desk. The documentation department hummed with hormonal female energy, and a half dozen of his co-workers found cause to cruise past his desk before he took his morning break. As he greedily scarfed up a box of warm Krispy Kremes, his cell phone rang. "Yeah," he said. The caller ID was the number of the international GSM phone he'd bought for Liam. "They're after us," Liam said. "I was at the Surrey border crossing, and the Canadian immigration guy had my pick." Murray's heart pounded. He concentrated for a moment, then his heart calmed, a jolt of serotonin lifting his spirits. "Did you get away?" "Of course I got away. Jesus, you think the CIA gives you a phone call? I took off cross-country, went over the fence for the duty-free, and headed for the brush. They shot me in the fucking leg. I had to dig the bullet out with my multi-tool. I'm sending in assloads of T-cells and knitting it as fast as I can." Panic crept up Murray's esophagus, and he tamped it down. It broke out in his knees, and he tamped it down. His balance swam. He stabilized it. He focused his eyes with an effort. "They shot you?" "I think they were trying to wing me. Look, I burned all the source code, source in 4096-bit GPG ciphertext on a couple of CDs, then zeroed out my drive. You gotta do the same. It's only a matter of time until they run my back trail to you. The code is our only bargaining chip. I'm at work. The backups are at home. I just can't." "Leave, asshole, like now. Go, get in your car and drive. Go home and start scrubbing the drives. I left a bottle of industrial paint stripper behind and a bulk eraser. Unscrew every drive casing, smash the platters, and dump them in the tub with all the stripper. Then put the tub into the bulk eraser. That should do it. Keep one copy, ciphertext only, and make the key a good one. Are you going? I'm badging out of the lot. Shit, shit, shit. What the fuck did you do to me? Don't, okay? Just don't. I've got my own problems. I've got to go now. I'll call you later, once I get somewhere." He thought hard on his way back to the condo, as he whipped down the off-peak emptiness of Highway 101. Being a coder was all about doing things in the correct order. First A, then B, then, if C equals D, E, otherwise, F. First, get home. Then set the stateful operation of his body for maximal efficiency. Reset his metabolism. Increase the pace of dendrite densification. Manufacture viralized antiviral in all his serum. Lots of serotonin and Atwell endorphin. There were hard times ahead. Next, encipher and back up the data onto a removable. Did he have any CD blanks at home? With eidetic clarity, he saw the half-spent spool of generic blanks on the second shelf of the media totem. Then trash the discs, pack a bag, and hit the road. Where to? He pulled into his driveway, hammered the elevator button a dozen times, then bolted for the stairs. Five flights later, he slammed his key into the lock and went into motion, executing the plan. The password gave him pause. Generating a 4096-bit key he could remember was going to be damned hard, but then he closed his eyes and recalled, with perfect clarity, the first five pages of documentation he'd written for the API. His finger rattled on the keys at speed. Zero typos. He was just dumping the last of the platters into the acid bath when they broke his door down. Half a dozen big guys in Martian riot gear, outsized science fiction black ops guns. One flipped up his visor and pointed to a badge clipped to a D-ring on his tactical vest. "Police," he barked. "Hands where I can see them." The serotonin flooded the murky gray recesses of Murray's brain, and he was able to smile nonchalantly as he straightened from his work, hands held loosely away from his sides. The cop pulled a zap strap from a holster at his belt and bound Murray's wrists tight. He snapped on a pair of latex gloves and untaped the interface from the back of Murray's neck, then slapped a bandage over it. "Am I under arrest?" "You're not cleared to know that," the cop said. "Special Agent Fredericks, right?" Murray said. "Liam told me about you." "Dig yourself in deeper, that's right. No one wants to hear from you. Not yet, anyway." He took a bag off his belt, then, in a quick motion, slid it over Murray's head, cinching it tight at the throat, but not so tight he couldn't breathe. The fabric passed air, but not light, and Murray was plunged into total darkness. "There's a gag that goes with the hood. If you play nice, we won't have to use it." "Oh, I'm nice, Murray said. "Bag it all and get it back to the house. You and you, take him down the back way." Murray felt the bodies near him, then thick zap straps cinching his arms, knees, thighs, and ankles. He tottered and tipped backwards, twisting his head to avoid smacking it. But before he hit the ground, he'd been roughly scooped up in a fireman's carry, resting on bulky body armor. As they carried him out, he heard his cell phone ring. Someone plucked it off his belt and answered it. Special Agent Frederick said, "Hello, Liam." Machine guns and biometrics bunkers have their own special signature scent, scrubbed air and coffee farts and ozone. They cut his clothes off and disinfected him, then took him through two air showers to remove particulate that the jets of icy pungent Lysol hadn't taken care of. He was dumped on a soft pallet, still in the dark. "You know why you're here," Special Agent Frederick said from somewhere behind him. "Why don't you refresh me?" He was calm and cool, heart normal, the cramped muscles bound by the plastic straps eased loose, relaxing under him. "We found two CDs of encrypted data on your premises. We can crack them given time, but it will reflect well on you if you assist us in our inquiries. Given about a billion years, no one can brute force a 4096-bit GPG cipher. It's what you use in your own communications. I've worked on military projects, you know that. If you could factor out the products of large primes, you wouldn't depend on them for your own security. I'm not getting out of here ever, no matter how much I cooperate." "You've got an awfully low opinion of your country, sir." Marie thought he detected a note of real anger in the Fed's voice, and he tried not to take satisfaction in it. "Why? Because I don't believe you've got magic technology hidden away up your asses? No, sir, because you think you won't get just treatment at our hands." "Am I under arrest?" "You're not cleared for that information." "We're at an impasse, Special Agent Fredericks. You don't trust me, and I don't have any reason to trust you."
"You have every reason to trust me," the voice said. "Very close in now."
"Why?" The hood over his tag was tugged to one side, and he heard a sawing sound as a knife hacked through the fabric at the base of his skull. Gloved fingers worked a plug into the socket there. "Because," the voice hissed in his ear, "because I am not stimulating the pain center of your brain, because I am not cutting off the blood supply to your extremities, because I am not draining your brain of all the serotonin there or leaving you in a vegetative state, because I can do all of these things, and I'm not." Murray tamped his adrenals, counteracted their effect, relaxed into his bonds. "You think you could outrace me? I could stop my heart right now, long before you could do any of those things, thinking, I am a total badass, I am, but I don't want to die."
"Tell him," Liam said.
"Liam?" Murray tried to twist his head towards the voice, but strong hands held it in place. "Tell him," Liam said again. We'll get a deal. They don't want us dead. They just want us under control. Tell him, okay?"
Murray's adrenals were firing at max now. He was sweating uncontrollably. His limbs twitched hard against his bonds, the plastic straps cutting into them, the pain surfacing despite his efforts. It hit him. His wonderful body was ownzored by the feds.
"Tell me, and you have my word, no harm will come to you. You'll get all the resources you want. You can code as much as you want."
Murray began to recite his key, all five pages of it, through the muffling hood. Liam was fully clothed, no visual restraints. As Murray chafed feeling back into his hands and feet, Liam crossed the locked office with its gray industrial carpet and tossed a set of khakis and a set of boxers to him. Murray dressed silently, then turned his accusing glare on Liam. "How far did you get?"
"I didn't even make it out of the state. They caught me in Sebastopol, took me off the Greyhound in cuffs with six guns on me at all times."
"The disks?" "They needed to be sure that you'd gotten rid of all the backups, that there wasn't anything stashed online or in a safe deposit box, that they had the only copy. It was their idea."
"Did you really get shot?"
"I really got shot. I hope it really fucking hurt."
"It really fucking hurt."
"Well, good." The door opened, and Special Agent Fredericks appeared with a big brown bag of frappuccinos and muffins. He passed them around.
"My people tell me that you write excellent documentation, Mr. Swain."
"What can I say? It's a gift. And they tell me that you have written some remarkable code."
"Another gift."
"We always need good coders here. What's the job pay? How are the bennies? How much vacation?"
"As much as you want. Excellent. As long as you want. Provided that we approve the destinations first. Once you're cleared."
"It's not enough," Murray said, upending 20 ounces of West Coast frou-frou caffeine delivery system on the carpet.
"Come on, Murray," Liam said. "Don't be that way."
Special Agent Fredericks fished in the bag and produced another novelty coffee beverage and handed it to Murray. "Make this one last. It's the only one that's left."
"With all due respect," Murray said, feeling a swell of righteousness in his chest, in his thighs, in his groin,
"go fuck yourself. You don't own me." They do, Murray said. They do, Murray, Liam said. They own both our asses. Liam stared into the puddle of coffee slurry on the carpet. Murray crossed the room as fast as he could and smacked Liam, open palm, across the cheek. That will do, Special Agent Frederick said, with surprising mildness. He needed smacking, Murray said, without rancor, and sat back down. Liam, why don't you wait for us in the hallway?
You came around, Liam said.
Everyone does. Those guys own. I didn't ask to share a room with you, Liam. I'm not glad I am. I'd rather not be reminded of that fact, so shut your fucking mouth before I shut it for you.
What do you want, an apology? I'm sorry. I'm sorry I infected you. I'm sorry I helped them catch you. I'm sorry I fucksored your life. What can I say?
You can shut up any time now. Well, this is going to be a swell living arrangement. The room was labeled Officer's Quarters, and it had two good, firm, queen-sized mattresses, premium cable, two identical stainless steel dressers, and two good ergonomic chairs. There were junction boxes beside each desk with locked covers that Murray supposed housed Ethernet ports. All the comforts of home. Murray lay on his bed and pulled the blankets over his head. Though he didn't need to sleep, he chose to. For 2 weeks, Murray sat at his assigned desk in his assigned cube and zoned out on the screensaver. He refused to touch the keyboard, refused to touch the mouse. Liam had the adjacent desk for a week, and then they moved him to another office so that Murray had solitude in which to contemplate the whirling starfield of the screensaver. He'd have a cup of coffee at 10:30 and start to feel a little sniffy in the back of his nose. He ate in the commissary at his own table. If anyone sat down at his table, he stood up and left. They didn't sit at his table. At 2 p.m., they'd send in a box of warm Krispy Kremes, and by 3 p.m., his blood sugar would be crashing, and he'd be sobbing over his keyboard. He refused to adjust his serotonin levels. On the third Monday, he turned up at his desk at 9 a.m. as usual and found a clipboard on his chair with a ballpoint tied to it. Discharge papers, non-disclosure agreements, cross your heart swears on pains of death, a modest pension, post-it sign here tabs had been stuck on here, here, and here. The junkie couldn't have been more than 15 years old. She was death camp skinny, tracked out, sitting cross-legged on a cardboard box on the sidewalk, sunning herself in the thin mission noonlight. Want to buy a laptop? $200. Murray stopped. Where'd you get it?
I stole it, she said, out of a convertible. It looks real nice. $150.
$200, Murray said, but you got to do me a favor. $300 and you wear a condom.
Not that kind of favor. You know the Radio Shack on Mission at 24th?
Get in this parts list and come back here. Here's a $100 down payment.
He kept his eyes peeled for the minders he'd occasionally spotted shadowing him when he went out for groceries, but they were nowhere to be seen. Maybe he'd lost them in the traffic on the 101. By the time the girl got back with the parts he'd need to make his interface, he was sweating bullets. But once he got the laptop open and began to rekey the entire code base, the eidetic rush of perfect memory dispelled all of his nervousness, leaving him cool and calm as the sun set over the mission. From the sky, Africa was green and lush, but once the plane touched down in Mogadishu, all Murray saw were sear brown plains and blowing dust. He sprang up from his seat, laundering the sleep toxins in his brain and the fatigue toxins in his legs and ass as he did. He was the first off the jetway and the first at the customs desk.
Do you have any commercial or work-related goods, sir?
No, sir, Murray said, willing himself calm.
But you have a laptop computer, the customs man said, eyeballing his case.
Oh, yeah, that. Can't ever get away from work. You know how it is.
I certainly hope you find time to relax, sir, the customs man said as he stamped the passport Murray had bought in New York.
When you love your work, it can be quite relaxing.
Enjoy your stay in Somalia, sir.
That's the end. Thank you.